Thank you very much for the invitation, Jim. I could say I invited myself because I helped Jim organize it. So, but I thought it was something that was really necessary to talk about Doc and do it in honor of Doc. I'll be a little less formal. I won't call him Dr. Camforth all the time because I didn't when I was there. He was either Dr. K or he was Doc. And you'll see both of those through my presentation. My ties to Dr. K. I was a graduate student there from 1972 to 1975. I also was a very, very good friend with Werner Nelson, who I believe was the primary advisor for Dr. K. That's what I remember talking to Werner and talking to Doc. And I say that because I got to know Dr. Nelson very, very well when I was an undergraduate and a grad student there at Purdue, where I started out. And when I was thinking about going on for a PhD, I decided I wanted to go outside the Midwest. Richard, no offense to Nebraska, but they had this incestuous relationship with Purdue back there in the 60s and 70s, where they sent all their graduate students to Purdue, and Purdue sent all theirs to Nebraska. And I decided I might learn something a little bit better if I went somewhere else outside of the Corn Belt. So Werner suggested I talk to Dr. K and apply to NC State, which I did. And fortunately, opportunity was there, so I got shipped off to the Black Lands of Eastern North Carolina and worked on liming problems with those high organic matter histosols for several years. Just a couple interesting things that kind of put in perspective the timeline of Doc's career. The concept of pH was really proposed in, 1909? If you think about it, wasn't all that old when we were down there. Electrodes first developed in 1920s, and Beckman developed the first pH meter. Actually, it was developed to measure the pH of lemon juice, funded by Sunkist, and he filed the first patent and developed his company. And then I got to thinking, I used one of those first instruments when I was a grad student at Purdue. We had one in a little wooden box. Soil testing and liming really took off as our science took off in right after World War II. And it was partly because of the scientific developments that were going on at that time. So we think of things, another name from NC State that was important was Doc Malik. Doc Malik developed the first buffer in 1939, or published it in 1939. Woodruff developed a similar one in the 40s in Missouri. Bray and Kurtz developed the Bray P1 in 45. So there's a huge amount of activity going on right before and during the time that Doc was in grad school down there at NC State. And then all the universities started developing soil testing labs. And all but one state university had some sort of a soil testing lab or program by 1960. So pretty interesting time, but if you think of all that, that's not that long ago. So, and I guess the focus of this is going to be there's a hell of a lot of change that goes on that we don't even recognize sometimes. I'm not sure it's going any faster than it did then, and I think that's a key point. So lime recommendations were developed, and this is kind of the key issue. Lime recommendations really started to develop by the 30s, 40s, 50s, and one of the focuses of a lot of that liming program, we made lime recommendations, we still make lime recommendations, so that you handle the most sensitive crop in a rotation. Because you don't change the pH overnight. And so that's still, right at the beginning of our soil testing recommendations for lime is that we make the recommendations to handle the needs of the most sensitive crop. And I just stole some information out of the old Purdue Agronomy Handbook. I'm kind of a history buff, so I keep a lot of this stuff. So I got a PDF of the 1961 Purdue Agronomy Handbook, which will, I'll tie this back into this in a second. But the recommendations in the late 50s and early 60s were if the pH was below 6.5 but more than 6.0, you put on 2 tons of lime. And the logic was lime is cheap. 2 tons is about the smallest amount you could apply and do a good job of spreading it. And there really wasn't any problem with overliming in most of the Midwest at that time. Now, that's not really true, because they had manganese and iron problems at times, but that's what they said. And then if it was below 6, they used a buffer to determine the lime rate. And this is just a figure out of there showing the dark solid lines, that's the range that is the optimum pH that was recommended. But the dashed lines were the lines where the pH ranges that were commonly utilized for crop production at that time. And in some cases, those were the recommended ones. For example, we had some organic soils in Indiana, and the optimum pH was about 5.2 for most crops. So that's kind of the way it worked. The key issue, though, for those lime recommendations is all the correlation and calibration work that went into developing that was done prior to World War II or shortly after. And nitrogen fertilizer wasn't being used. I can remember in about, it would have been about 1960, I started farming, okay? That's kind of crazy, but I did. I started farming and going to the co-op and making arrangements to get anhydrous ammonia applied to corn, to be side-dressed to corn, and we were going to put on 40 pounds of nitrogen per acre, side-dressed for corn, okay? And we'd put on, I think, 100 pounds of 20-20-0 at planting time. So we were just starting to really use nitrogen fertilizer, so the rotation, and particularly the use of forage legumes in my part of the world that I grew up in northern Indiana, that was red clover, that was a really important part of that, because we did that primarily to provide in for the subsequent corn crops. So that was really a key thing. So the lime recs, yes, that was the optimum for the rotation, but it also assumed you were going to have a clover in there to provide the nitrogen, because it wasn't available all that much. This is just to sort of illustrate this point. These are nitrogen use in the U.S. in million short tons. You'll have to excuse me, I'm not going to use SI units. I'm an extension guy. Well, actually, I'm not even that anymore. I'm a farmer now. So, in 1960, we used 2.74 short million tons of nitrogen in the U.S. By 1970, when Dopp published a pretty important paper on liming in a different approach, that had increased to 7.4, and by 1980, when I was a new green extension guy in Indiana working on corn, we were up, we actually peaked at about that time at 11.4. So, and what's the significance of nitrogen and liming? Well, the one's the recommendation is to get the legumes to grow if you don't use it, and the other is it's the acidifying force in most of the situations we deal with. The other thing that was going on was a significant shift in crop acres. I've got different periods there, 1930, 50, 70, 90, and 2010. And if you look at the shift in acres, I thought this was really significant. Look at cotton down there about the fifth line. There were 43 million acres of cotton grown in the United States in 1930. There's now somewhere around 10 or 11. Oats. 43 million acres of oats grown. There's now 3. Corn actually has decreased from 104 to about 88, and it's still right about that point. The other interesting one is soybeans. They're towards the bottom. 3 million acres of soybeans, and those were produced for hay, not grain. And now we're at 77. So there's been some really tremendous shifts in our cropping systems over the years, that are also have played a large part in a little bit of controversy that developed with some of the ideas that Doc proposed. The other part of that that's kind of interesting is the total acres involved in agriculture, in crop production, has dropped from 367 million to 315. Now, Doc was pretty heavily involved in the Trop Soils program. Pedro was heavily involved in that program at the same time. There's a lot of effort going on there at NC State. And that took people to some different places, but NC State was pretty appropriately selected for that because the soils in the Southeast were a lot more similar to the soils in Brazil or parts of Argentina or Peru than were the soils in Indiana, okay, or Ohio, which will be a significant state here in a second. And so the program, that one of the key things, and I think one of the key things about Doc, and I'm sure that Bill will probably mention this when he talks about some of his nitrogen work, and Andrew will probably mention it talking about phosphorus. Doc was a team player, and he was an integrator. And I think that's one of the very important traits that he had as a person that allowed him to make some of the contributions he did. Because a lot of things, like as Jim said, he didn't talk about what he did. He talked about what his team members did or his students did. And that was a key point. But it brought together a lot of different people to address some of the fertility and acidity needs of many of these tropical soils. Many of them had ties to the southeastern U.S. and were familiar with the types of soils, so it all worked sort of together. So instead, in 1970, Doc published a paper, Exchangeable Aluminum as a Criteria for Liming Leached Mineral Soils. And that's a kind of an important time frame because I had just finished my bachelor's and was starting on a master's, and I'm beginning to think about grad school and projects and whatever. And Warner Nelson was telling me to go to North Carolina State. But that research showed that, and if you read the introduction to that paper, he talks about a lot of other people and the contributions they made and the ideas that he built that research on. And what he was trying to do was actually integrate a lot of people's ideas and set them forth with some good hard data to back up the things that were there. So he didn't claim most of the ideas that were there. Again, he just integrated things and proved some of these things in a practical sense, which is really important. So the idea was that we'll do a neutral salt extract. KCl was the one that traditionally was used. Titrate it, determine how much exchangeable aluminum was there, and then make some multiple of lime application based on the mill equivalents of exchangeable aluminum. And the system worked pretty nicely. And for most of the soils, they were talking about 1.5 times the neutral acidity. And using dolomitic lime, if possible, to supply all the calcium and magnesium and take care of the aluminum toxicity. And if you took care of the aluminum, you had it raise the pH enough to take care of the aluminum, it took care of the manganese problem also. But some of the old boys in the Midwest didn't quite agree with that approach. There were some ruffled feathers. And so now here's this kid in a lab in Indiana thinking about going to NC State. And E.O. McLean and Camprath are exchanging letters to the editor in the journal talking about this concept that, incidentally, I'm supposed to work on because I'm supposed to take in that same concept and expand it for organic soils. So needless to say, there was a little heartburn there for a while. But McLean's point was that you needed to raise pH to 6.5, do all these wonderful things in the soil, enhance nutrient availability, soil microbial activity, lots of things like that. But Doc, in the very calm manner, as he always had, pointed out that there was a lot of research from the North Central region, including right next door in Indiana from where McLean was in Ohio, that pointed out that you didn't need to have pH 6.5. Orogi published a paper on that, showing that a lot of times raising the pH that high actually created nutrient problems with things like manganese and zinc there in Indiana. In Missouri, they showed the same sort of thing. And Doc also commented that some of those recommendations were a little old and hadn't been updated for a long time, and that we didn't use foraged legumes as a nitrogen source anymore. Though they still did in Ohio in defense of Dr. McLean. So, who's right in this whole thing? I think both of them were to a certain extent. Doc McLean was correct because in Northwest Ohio, which is where his little world was, the SMP buffer was developed for Northwest Ohio with high exchange capacity soils. Doesn't work worth a damn on sands, but it works great on CECs of 30 and higher, okay? But in that same area, they still use red clover because they had a corn, soybean, wheat rotation. They didn't have enough growing season after harvesting wheat to grow any other double crop, so they continued to interseed with red clover to have a cover crop and to provide nitrogen. The practice is still done in some of that area. So McLean was sort of right in his own special little world that he worked with. But in the broader context, there were other places that didn't have CEC of 40 and they were different, and consequently Doc had a different approach. If you looked at the southeastern U.S., if you looked at the tropics, if you looked at Brazil, if you looked at Peru, if you looked at parts of Africa, soils were very different. They responded differently. The mineralogy was different. The role of aluminum was much more important as compared to the hydrogen and organic matter that you had in Ohio. Crop rotations were very different. They did a lot of different crops. So selecting a target pH based on the crops that were being grown, the rotations that were being utilized, and the resources that were available, because, oh, by the way, they didn't have lime in many of the areas that the exchangeable aluminum process was being, or at least at that time, those resources hadn't been developed. It was very expensive. So the real key to the argument was utilizing the available tools to solve local problems, and that's one of the real keys. There is no one-size-fits-all for most of these things that we do, though sometimes we think about it that way. If you think about the test of time, today we see in many parts of the world that soil acidity is still an issue. Where I work in central Kansas and in southern Kansas, it's a very big problem. What we're finding is that there are many different approaches being used to address this problem in different places. In Kansas, we have three different liming recommendations. Are three different ways to handle lime problems. In eastern Kansas, lime's available, pHs are generally low, it's easily resolved cheaply. We go on and we recommend that we lime, depending on the crop, anywhere from 6 to 6.8. If you go to south central Kansas, and I'll show you these pictures in a second, we don't have lime, but we got acid soils as low as pH 4.5. And they're low CEC, and they're low organic matter. And we use, in some ways, Doc's approach. We have no-till production systems. In Brazil, they started into no-till. One of the problems they had was that they could add lime, but they couldn't affect the subsoil. And so they had to come up with some other ideas to get calcium and to neutralize some of that pH in the subsoil. So there's lots of things that go in here. I'll just give you a quick idea about what we do in the Great Plains. There's a picture from a field plot, pH 4.5 on the right with wheat, pH 5.1 on the left. That's a long way below 6.5, okay? And if you look at yield response to liming, 3,000 pounds of effective calcium carbonate raises the pH to 5.1. The soluble aluminum drops down to right at our critical level of 25. And yields are optimized. pretty important point. So we're still listening to some of the things that Doc did. The other thing we're doing is we're using variety selection. So the interaction of genetics and soil fertility come into play. You see across the top of that slide, there's a nice uniform green strip there. That's an area that was limed, and that was limed up to about pH 6. This is a variety performance trial under acid conditions, and there are four row strips, and there's different varieties named there. This is about 10 years old. But if you look there, you'll see there's some of them that, even not limed at pH of around 4.7, are doing pretty darn good. So the breeders have given us acid-tolerant materials, and I'm told by the sorghum breeders that's coming shortly also. They'll be giving us acid-tolerant sorghum varieties. So this is going to be a big improvement, a big step. So we all need to be open-minded, like Dr. Camperth was, and his colleagues generally were, that he worked with, and his teams down there. And conditions aren't really the same everywhere, and we have to really think about basic concepts and principles when we start putting together extension recommendations and dealing with farmers and the industries. People are fortunate enough to travel and work in different parts of the world, or even like myself, different parts of the country, rather than all staying in the Corn Belt, are exposed to a lot of different ideas and cultures and things, and can understand that, you know, maybe there are different mousetraps, not necessarily better mousetraps, but more appropriate for a given area that we need to be thinking about. The exchange and sharing of ideas at places like this, Doc was very supportive of getting graduate students to meetings like this and other smaller meetings around the country. So I think it's really important to think about some of this and still continue to learn lessons from Dr. K. If you have any questions, I know we're probably running just about out of time. My email address is there. I am retired, but I still use my K-State email for all my business-related things. Feel free to send me an email, and we'll go from there. Thank you very much.